In a memo to Kansas City Star employees back in the spring, Mike Fannin informed his staff of some editorial restructuring plans, which would include some, quote, painful contractions. After several rounds of layoffs at the paper, it was not hard to guess what that meant, but seeing the name Tim Finn on the list came as a shock to the music community. Tim has commented on pop culture and reviewed rock shows for so long that his presence has become part of the whole experience. You can spot him taking notes from somewhere near the soundboard. You'd try to read his expression to predict what he was going to say in the paper the next morning. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, Tim joins us in the studio to look back on 22 years reviewing music for the Star. We'll also hear the story of how he raised two teenage daughters on his own. I'm Gina Kaufman. Tim Finn, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gina.
Okay, so I don't want to dwell on the layoff, but it's pretty recent news, and I think a lot of listeners are probably wondering how you're doing and what's next.
I'm doing well. Yes, it was a surprise, but not a shock, because we all know what's been going on at the Star and other newspapers for a decade now. But my plans are, I mean, I've got a couple of freelance things going already. I'm doing social media for a music venue in town. And my plan
to show what that
is. Oh, Knuckleheads. Mm-hmm. Knuckleheads, yeah. They're a busy, busy venue. And then my plan is to get a music blog going, I hope, by this time next month.
And is it the case? Will you be able to hold on to the Back to Rockville?
I will. The Star said I could have that name. They were really gracious about that. So, yes. And I think I can go back and revive what it was before we moved it inside the under the paper's website. So it will be just like it was, I hope.
And how was that?
How was that?
Yeah.
The doing that blog?
No. What was it like? What was different about it back then?
Well, it was... There was no paywall, so it was free. We got a lot of discussion. We ended up, there was a large group of readers who became friends. They would meet at shows. So it was this community. It was policed. It policed itself. We allowed some snark, but we didn't allow anything malicious. So some people got tossed out. And it was just a really good thing. And when it went away, a lot of people were really sad. So I'm hoping to regenerate that again.
Cool. Well, take me back to your early days as the Star's music critic. We're talking mid to late 90s, right?
Right. So I'd been freelance writing for the Star. I was a copy editor and a page designer at the Star when I started here. And for about 6 years, I was doing the shows that the other music writers didn't want to do. And I did some
like
movie.
What?
The first show I ever did was some version of The Grassroots at Crown Center, because they used to do shows there every Friday in the summer. But then I did like Warrant and Rat and Poison out at Sandstone. And I think I did Marshall Tucker and the Beach Boys or something weird like that. So it was, there were some decent shows, but it was shows I normally wouldn't have seen. And that really helped me sort of adapt to appreciating music that other people like that maybe I don't.
What music had you been more into at that point?
I was pretty much indie rock, alternative rock, and I grew up with a lot of older siblings and cousins. So, you know, the Beatles were my big bang in my life. That was the first music I really fell in love with. But then, you know, Paul Simon, Simon and Garfunkel, a lot of that stuff.
Warrant was a new direction for sure.
Completely, yes. But you know what? I enjoyed that show, which was enlightening. Like, I never would have come to this show. I might not listen to this music again, but that was fun.
What did you enjoy about it?
I enjoyed how much everyone else was enjoying it, mostly. And it just showed me that being inside that community for a while, it's sort of... put to rest some maybe stereotypes or biases I might have had before then.
How did the gig of being a pop culture and music critic, how did that change over time?
It changed significantly. There was a show I went to the first time I saw Metallica, another band I didn't really listen to. I knew a couple of their songs, and they played out at Sandstone. It was 20,000 people were there. I interviewed their lead singer, James Hetfield, a few weeks before, and I was nervous about that interview. I had I had some preconceptions about him.
Like what?
That he was surly, that he was going to be difficult to interview. And I don't know where this came from. I just expected that, I guess. And he was one of the nicest guys I've ever talked to. So that changed my attitude a little bit. But then when I was in the middle of 20,000 people who loved the band loved them back, people were not leaving. This was kind of, cell phones were just starting, so that wasn't really a problem back then. But people were locked into the show, singing along. And I just remember thinking, you know, some of my favorite bands don't get the reaction this band is getting. And it changed the way I do reviews pretty much. It's like, then I started writing about the experience of the show and not reviewing the music so much, because it's a little late to review the music when you're at the show. Everyone who's there already loves the music. So, because the one or two times where I did get into the music and maybe said something disparaging, people would say, well, why did you go to the show if you don't like the band? And so I always kept that in mind, that and made the review more a narrative of how the experience went from start to finish. How
because
the crowd
it's after the fact. That's a different kind mm-hmm. of thing as far as what its use is. What right. do you think is the use? I mean, for a musician, a good review serves a purpose career-wise. But for the average reader, what do you think that those reviews do for people?
Well, some people who read them can't go to shows. I mean, I've had people tell me that a lot. Either they couldn't get a ticket or they're physically unable to go out into arenas and big venues. So for them, it's just, it's like kind of recounting a baseball game the night before, maybe, I guess, you know, because this is kind of a box score. I always give the set list. For people who were there, I know some people who have cut out my reviews and framed them because this show meant so much to them. And now they have a physical reminder of it other than a ticket stub.
Yeah, so. I've had the experience of sending around reviews with people who you went to the show with. Mm-hmm. It's a way of just like continuing the conversation.
Right. I mean, I realized that it meant things to readers when I didn't do a show and they were emailing me and say, how come you didn't do this show? Or
yeah, it's like it puts it's like the nightcap or something, but right. it happens the next day usually.
Right. So, yeah. And I just think it's you never know what's going to happen at a show. I mean, somebody could fall off a stage or could be an incident that would need to be reported. So especially the big shows, we always wanted to have somebody there just in case there's a surprise or just when there are that many people there, I think the paper needs to document that in some way.
What is it like just in a person's existence to review rock shows for a living? Are there things about it that aren't what people typically assume?
You know, it's when you have to do, or when I had to do like 6 shows in 8 days, that can be pretty grueling. And the schedule can be like that, especially this time of the year. The first time Garth Brooks came to town, he did 9 shows in 10 days.
I remember that. Did you have to go to all 9?
Went to all of them.
Why?
Well, it got every show got a huge response. I mean, he hadn't performed in almost 10 years. So people were reading them online from Europe. I mean, people were flying in. I met someone from Ireland who went to 2 of the shows. So that was an enormous deal. And once we saw what kind of response it was getting, I just said, well, we'll do them all. I kind of regretted that after like the 6th show.
But also, as a journalist, you're not someone who works in the music scene exclusively. You're also someone who works with colleagues who have 9 to 5 hours. Mm-hmm. How do you pull it off?
That was rough, especially you know, over the past few years, with all the analytics about web traffic, the edict was to get the reviews in before 6 a.m. So that meant either staying up till 3 or 3:30 and writing, or writing for a while, going to sleep for a couple hours, and then getting back up. So that could be rough. And then there was, like you said, stuff to do later that day. So there was some sleep deprivation involved.
What would you say your philosophy as a music critic has been? Are there certain principles and beliefs that have guided you? I mean, you mentioned that thing of appreciating what other people appreciate. Mm-hmm. What else?
I don't think music has never been a means for me to be angry or vindictive or cruel. I just never could understand, like, if you don't like something, then don't write about it. I mean, unless there's a really good reason to disagree with somebody. And I'm all about, you know, some logical, diplomatic disagreements or, you know, criticism. But especially when it comes to local bands, if I see a local band or listen to their record and I think it doesn't really cut the mustard, then I don't write about it. Because local bands are such a different entity. Most of them are losing money. They're doing it because they love to do it.
Not talking about them, you know, it's interesting because I could see the argument for, like, well, no, like the word critic, you know, you got to do the bad reviews too. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I get what you're saying. It's sort of like, if no one's talking about them, it's not like,
right,
the people right. who are going like it, mm-hmm. they're maybe those people's friends, let them have fun.
Right. And I guess, you know, it's not like reviewing a restaurant where you want to tell people you might want to wait before you come eat here. You know, they're new, or you have legitimate criticism of how they're making their cuisine. But I think for this, it usually works itself out. The really good local bands tend to emerge, and then I can write about them on par with the national and regional bands, which is what I would do. But I typically picked, there are enough good bands around here that I could pick bands I like, bands that I felt were good enough to write about. So that was never a problem.
You know, your background in journalism isn't specifically to do music reviews. You have a pretty extensive background, and you got into it really young.
Well, yeah, I was writing for newspapers and for the newspaper when I was in eighth grade, and I did a lot of writing on the side. My family went to the library all the time. We read a lot, and subsequently, I did a lot of just writing on the side. When I was a senior in high school, a few friends and I restarted the high school newspaper from scratch. And that was a blast. But I'd already known then that I wanted to go into journalism. I'd kind of decided when teachers were telling me I was a good writer. And so I never really looked back from that. Going back to high school and even, you know, like I said, element or grade school, it was always something I wanted to do.
Like I said earlier, you are a very recognizable figure. And that includes your hair, Tim Finn.
Yes, I get comments about it a lot.
Could you describe your hair?
Well, it's not gray, it's silver. That's what I say.
That's a fair assessment.
And I get it from my mother. I'll say that. And I have her hair in her eyes. But yeah, I don't know. I've worn it like this since I can remember. I don't really do much to it. I pay like $12 for a haircut.
But what overall has visibility been like for you within this community as a music critic?
You know, it's been exceptional. It's people have been coming up to me and saying, where are your reviews? So I know people are looking for them and recognize me. People I don't know are doing this. And so I have to break it to them. But, you know, it's always good. I mean, you must know what this feels like to get that kind of response and that kind of recognition. And it was one of the benefits of the job. And I got it doing something that I love to do. So, yes, it was all good.
But despite how recognizable you are, there is so much that people don't know about you. You know, as you were getting this career going, you were also starting a family.
Right. So, I was, like I said, the first 7 years I was at the I started at the Times and then moved to the Star. I was doing copy editing. I was doing page design. I was doing news editing. And I was doing stuff on the side. And our first daughter was born in 1992. And then our second daughter was born in 94. And so it was when my younger daughter was two or three is when I started doing the music thing. And then shortly after that, their mother, Lauren Chapin, became Star's food writer and restaurant critic. So my kids have this period in their life where their mother was going out, and they would go with her or us and eating at all these restaurants, and it was paid for. And then I was going to shows and bringing home music that was free. And I don't know what they were thinking, but they must have thought, wow, this is what I want to do, or this is, you know, what a glorious life. And it was. And they were a big part of that a lot of the times.
And one of the gut-wrenching parts of your story, there are a few of those, is that Lauren died really unexpectedly, and your daughters were pretty young.
Yeah, it was about 2 weeks before Christmas, 2008, and Lauren had been born with this condition called an AVM. It has to do with blood vessels, and there was an aneurysm. The M stands for malfunction. Anyway, she apparently had hers all her life. Hers was just in a really bad place. It was right at her brainstem.
Did she know about it?
No, you wouldn't know about it unless you had a reason to go look for it. But yeah, she left. The kids left for school one morning. She went to the gym, and the last thing she said was, I'm going to the gym. I'll see you at work. And then they called from there about 20 minutes later. And yes, it had ruptured. She was still alive, but it was about 2 days later that she died.
And how old were your kids?
They were 14 and 16.
I mean, from a distance, I have watched your journey as a single dad with two girls who are trying to get by without their mom. And I know that a lot of things about it must be really tough. You've also really thrown yourself into that.
Yeah, I had a lot of help from Lauren's family and from my family and some friends. But there are plenty of moments where you know, things occurred that they really needed their mother, but I had to fill that role. And my kids are great. They've been so strong throughout it all. They made it, it hasn't been easy, but they made it easier. They adjusted to it right away as much as they could, but they still have really, really difficult times. There were times when I would get a call from one of them when they were at college at 2 a.m. and just like, I miss her so much right now. So getting through that is tough. Mother's Day is always tough. So are the holidays, their birthdays. But it doesn't get easier. At some point, it just stops getting harder, and you kind of adjust to that constant sorrow.
How has this changed how you see your role as a father? I mean, has your own fatherhood journey, I know it has to be different from what you expected in some like logistical ways and some emotional ways, but like the actual core of what it is to be a father, has that changed for you on some level too? Or
yeah, I think so. The thing was when Lauren was alive, she traveled a lot. So there were regularly periods of times where she was gone for a week to 10 days. Once when they were, I think they were 4 and 6, she got a Rotary scholarship to go to India for 5 weeks. So that was a big chunk of time. And I remember after she died thinking, the first couple of weeks, like we'd kind of hit a stride. I'm like, well, this is kind of, I think, all in the back of our heads are like, well, she's just gone. You know, we've been through this before. And we sort of hit our stride. We each knew what to do when she wasn't there. So I was familiar with that kind of identity of doing both. But I don't know, I don't think it changed my relation or my sense of who I was as a parent, because I never really separated me being a father or what. I was one of their parents, and I was going to be there for them and, you know, try to make them grow into be good adults.
It being the case that you were a father and that these were daughters and that there is something about, you know, about that mother-daughter relationship that's different, or can be. I mean, maybe not for everyone, but How you said that you grew into filling that hole as best you could. Mm-hmm. Can you give an example of a time where you found kind of a surprising way to step in? Or
I guess I never I never thought I could fulfill who Lauren was to them, because she was a super mom. I mean, anyone who knew her will tell you what, I mean, she was, she didn't sit still, and she set goals and she achieved them. After my sister died, in 2003, Lauren was really as hit hard by it as any of us, 'cause they were close. She had heard about Ragbri, this bike ride across Iowa. Every July they do it. Started in the east or western border and go east. And she decided she was going to do it and raise money in my sister's name. So she had this really old bike. She went up there. We drove her up there. And people were there were laughing at her because her bike was like 20 years old. And she's like, I don't care. I'm going to do it. And she did it. And she did it every year after that, including 2008. Became a really good cyclist. Joined all these cycling clubs. So she was, I mean, she set that kind of example. And you know, when she started writing about food, she wanted to learn more about wine. She got her sommelier certificate. She ended up being a beer judge at the Great Beer Fest in Denver. So that's the kind of example she set, and that my kids knew that about her, and they both have that in them. So my kids and I were kind of more, I was kind of a friend. I got them into sports. We would go to Royals games. My daughter became a huge KU basketball fan. We went to KU games. So that didn't change. But I knew there was other things that needed to be tended to. And I did that kind of as they came along. When one of them got, you know, my daughter got sick and had a sort of a woman's problem, you know, I had to be there with her. She was a little embarrassed. But you know what? It was just like, we got to take care of this, you know. So there were those moments. And then, you know, there's, I need my birth control renewed or stuff like that, you know, like, okay, whatever. And then dealings with boyfriends and bad breakups, you know, it's just, it's in front of you and you have to take care of it the best you can.
And you've been there to watch them leave the nest too.
Yes. Which is, it's the most difficult thing is knowing that you've raised them to be independent is great. But when they're not in your life every day, it can be heavy.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We have to take a quick break. When we return, we'll hear more of the Tim Finn story. This is an encore broadcast of one of our favorite shows from 2018 on KCUR's Central Standard. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're getting to know Tim Finn. He became the Kansas City Star's pop music critic in 1996. He's interviewed most of the pop icons you probably wish you could hang out with, and he's spent most of his career going to rock shows for a living. But his personal journey behind the scenes has had a lot of love, a lot of loss, and new beginnings. As a husband and father, brother and son, Tim Finn, welcome back.
Thank you, Gina.
Tell me about your childhood. Where did you grow up?
I was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and when after I finished first grade, my father got transferred to Niagara Falls. So we moved into this little town called Youngstown, which is right on Lake Ontario. You can see the Toronto skyline across the lake on a clear day, and there's a Revolutionary Fort there. It's a quaint little village, there were seven of us then when we moved, and then my mother had, we had another child late, unexpectedly. So I grew up with seven siblings, six sisters and a brother.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have a lot of siblings, but we weren't all in the house at the same time. Were you guys all close enough together that it really was like all of you in the house?
Yeah, it was through high school. Well, my senior year of high school, my oldest sister was in college, so that was the first break. But there was a time where my brother and I had, it was he and I on bunk beds, and my youngest sister was in a crib at the foot of our bed because that's the only place we could put her.
Were you the reporter of the household? Was like, you talked about how early you got interested in journalism. Mm-hmm. Did you have a role in your family that kind of reflected that?
No, usually I was kind of a jerk. I teased my sisters mercilessly and fought with my brother all the time because He was the only one I could hit. So, I mean, 8 kids. I mean, just raising two. Every day I would admire my parents even more, knowing what they went through, what they were put through. It was easy to get, I mean, kind of lost. You know, it's basically you do a head count and then it's, so there was some anonymity to it, but we also had a lot of fun. My dad force fed us Irish folk music. So, and he would have friends over and we would all get together and he'd make us sing all these Irish folk songs, but it was fun.
Your dad worked for the CIA.
He did. Yes.
Did you know what he did?
Well, I do now. About 2 or 3 years ago, for Father's Day in the Star, I wrote a piece about this is what my father was, and this is what I think he did. And I talked about what it was like to be raised in a place where your father, you don't know what he does when he leaves the house, or he goes on a 3-day trip to Paducah, Kentucky, or just, you know, where's dad? Oh, he's gone. You know, he'll be home Thursday. Or you'd go into his office, there'd be a typewriter and a legal pad, and that was it. And
just
he
talked, no clues.
Hmm?
No clues.
No clues. And he talked to my mother about what he did, but he rarely said anything to us about it. When he did, it was so cryptic that we didn't really know what he was telling us.
There wasn't like some decoy other job he was going to?
No. So I wrote this piece, and I basically framed it as my father was a spy, and this is what he did. And when I was attending Mizzou, he was coming out there once a month or so, and he would call me before and say, I'm going to be out there. If you see me, you can't recognize me. So I thought he was spying, pretending to be somebody else and fooling the people he was with. But so I wrote this piece in the Star, and then a few months later, I got an email from a colleague of his who set me straight and said, your dad was an intelligence officer. The people he was talking to, they were meeting with him voluntarily and they knew who he was and what he was doing. But he was protecting their anonymity. He didn't want they didn't want to be seen with someone who knew what my dad did. So, and he just said, the way he put it, he goes, he was looking for very specific needles and very specific haystacks. And it was digging for small scraps of information to put it together for whatever reason.
Do you think he might have been partly also trying to protect you by keeping you unaware and like just not mixed up in it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we never knew because he retired in 1985, the first day he was eligible to retire because he was tired of it. And within a month he was sick and then he died within the year. He had lung cancer. So we never really got to get anything out of him. He went so fast. So and my mother doesn't really talk about it much. I think it pains her to talk about it. So it was really enlightening to hear someone who worked with my dad, who had all these gracious things to say about him, but also said he was elite at what he did. And he was really admired in the agency for it.
But what was that like when your dad was leaving the house and you just had no clue what he did? I think on some level, that's true of the parent-child relationship to varying degrees, no matter what. But to truly, like, just, I have no idea what's happening right. By design.
Right. And, you know, he had these credentials, you know, like you would flash if you were an FBI agent. So we saw that. And sometimes he worked with someone in his office and maybe they would come over and you might catch a little bit of a conversation about what they were doing, but it never made any sense. And one time he took me on a road trip with him and I ended up sitting in a lobby somewhere reading a book. And then he came down and we had lunch and he was taking notes copiously during lunch. We really didn't talk and then talked a little bit on the way home, but he was obviously thinking about what he had done, but I had no idea who he met with or why he was there.
Do you think that the fact that that journalism is a career that the whole idea is I am a person asking questions, looking for the truth, and putting it out there really publicly.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of an interesting, like, right. Funhouse mirror image of intelligence agent.
Except right.
That last part.
And, you know, if you're a critic, you're supposed to be anonymous-ish. But, You know, my dad actually said writing is a big part of what he did. And he told me if I thought I wanted to do what he was doing, he could start the wheels going. But I got the impression he didn't really want me to, like, because it really, his sister, my aunt, told me that he was the last 10 years, he was just really ready to get out. He was tired of it. Except there was a time for 3 years, he spent 3 years in this place called Camp Perry in Williamsburg, Virginia, which is an old army base they've turned into what it's basically a CIA college. So he was a professor there teaching recruits his ways, and he loved it so much. I think it broke him when he left because he only worked for like 3 more years, but that was the pinnacle of his career. He was so happy talking, being around people who had done what he had done and he could share everything with.
You mentioned that your dad died just very shortly after retiring. What was going on in your life at that time? Where were you living? What were you doing?
I was in Lawrence, Kansas, getting my master's. Yeah, I went to Mizzou, got a degree in journalism, but I, for some reason, got into advertising. I don't know what happened there. at the last minute, I jumped over to NewsEd. I didn't have enough behind me to get a newspaper job. So I'd heard about KU as a journalism school. I went back and did it over. Was going into magazine design, actually, when a professor there, John Bremner, I took a couple of his editing classes, and he told me, this is what you should do. You know, newspapers need people like you. So that's why I became a copy editor. But I was at KU finishing up my master's.
And your mom was in another state?
Right. She moved back to where we'd grown up, back to Youngstown or Lewiston, and she's still there. So she picked up and bought a house, and it's close to, I have 3 sisters who live there. So she had family and she had grandkids nearby at the time.
You've dealt with so much loss. You lost your sister too, as you've mentioned, mm-hmm. losing a sister, a father, a wife, all of them before their time.
Mm-hmm.
Does that shape in some way how you live your life, how you see your life?
Yeah. The really strange thing is there's been a lot of early death in my family. My father's mother died when he was 3 months old. So he was raised by his dad and his aunts. His sister, her husband was killed in a car accident when she had a 5, 3, and 1-year-old. And my parents were there for her for like a year. And then my sister left 6-year-old twins. And then, you know, Lauren died and my kids don't have a mother. So it's almost like, not to be melodramatic, but I remember at Lauren's funeral, one of my nephews said, it's like there's a curse. I said, well, or just a lot of really dark coincidences.
I mean, how do you see life? I mean, do you think that affects the way you see life?
Absolutely. It affects what I don't worry about and how the trivial things don't even barely reach me, you know, whether it's being cut off in traffic or, you know what I'm talking about. It's a little, the stuff that annoys you.
Aggravations.
If you won't let it, but then I think, no. And the other thing that it revealed, and my daughters, you know, told me this, they had friends in high school whose father was killed in a school bus accident in Liberty. And then about 3 years later, their mother killed herself. So they lost both their parents within 3 years. And they would just say, this is bad for us, but it could be worse. I mean, always keeping in mind that as bad as your situation may be, acknowledge the blessings. And we had so many friends and so much help from family. And that really buoyed us and helped us get through and still helps us get through the hard times. But to answer your question, yeah, it's like not sweating the small stuff because you never know when something huge is going to happen on a day when you're not expecting it.
And you'll wish you were enjoying that good time while it was there.
Absolutely.
Earlier, we talked about what it was like to become a single father, but we didn't really talk about how you got through that loss, not just for your daughters, but for yourself.
That was, you know, out of all the losses, of all the deaths, and I've couple of really close friends have died in the last few years. The thing about Lauren's is, well, we had been friends for, we were married for 17 years. We've been friends for like 19. So that was just a huge loss. It was somebody who'd been in my life that long, and we had children together. We started a house together. I'm still not over it. I mean, I don't expect to be over it. And part of what's probably affected the way I grieve about it is, from the beginning, I was always more worried about our kids. And I knew, for the first time, it was like I knew that this is someone I'm responsible for, and they're going to be dealing with this for the rest of their lives. And I sort of focused on them. But yeah, it'll be 10 years in December, and I'm still putting pieces back together.
But this past weekend, as many people in the music community know, you actually remarried. And we're listening to the song Your New Bride Walked Down the Aisle to at the Record Bar, of course.
Well, we got married at the Pilgrim Chapel. Oh, so the ceremony is at the Pilgrim Chapel. And then, yes, Michelle, this is one of her favorite Beatles songs. And yeah, we did. It was great. We'd been dating for about 5 years. It was time. And we'd known each other for about 10. So we met through music. And it was the day was perfect. It couldn't have gone better.
What's it been like to open yourself up to this new beginning?
It's good. I mean, I'm ready for it. And like I said, I am as certain about it as I can be. My daughters love her and her son. It just feels absolutely right.
And you're a stepdad now too, right?
Right, to a 14-year-old boy who's a genius. That's a little intimidating. He's our IT director in the house. He can fix or program anything. He's a great kid, super smart and musical.
And from what I've heard about your wedding and what I've seen on social media, it does seem like it was kind of a chance for the music community here in town to surround you with love. I mean, is that in some ways your family too at this point?
Absolutely. There were a lot of great things about our reception at the Record Bar. And one of them was mingling with these people I've been writing about and as a friend. And
now that you're not a critic.
Right. And they all showed up, and it was great to see them mingle with each other. A lot of them hadn't seen each other in a while. And on the other side, a lot of my star alumni were there, a lot of them. And some of them hadn't seen each other in 6 or 7 or 8 years. And watching those people get together was really touching.
This interview with Tim Finn originally aired back in June. Nowadays, Tim writes reviews for In Kansas City magazine. He also does social media for Knuckleheads. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're counting down the moments until the end of 2018 by listening to some of our favorite shows from the year. Coming up, we'll hear some music from a local artist. He blends the sound of the ukulele with R&B. Meet Eames next on KCUR Central Standard.